Hello and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show Network's dedicated podcast related to all things comic book, manga, and other graphic, illustrated, serial media. And I'm joined this week, now that the dust has settled over our massive crossover event and not everyone survived, Rob.
Hello, I did survive.
And no one else.
Not even.
That's how terrible this crossover event was.
Not even you survived. I'm assuming I'm talking to the ghost of Mick.
No, I did survive, but this is the point where I've had to add to my CV, because obviously I've periodically updated my CV just in case there are, you know, other more grown-up podcasts that want my skills.
Does it now just say mad survival skills on your CV?
Well, no, you know that bit where it says able to work unsupervised on his own?
Yes.
But also works part as a as part of a team. I've now added works well as part of an intergalactic cross-dimensional task force.
Okay, that works.
Yeah. So, so that's what I've been up to since our massive crossover event and the fallout from it. That and I've been traipsing through the jungles of Wakanda and Vietnam, but more of that later.
Yes.
What news have you, Sir Rob?
Me? I have news that we have no Andrew this week.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of hinting at the lack of survivors from our massive crossover event. But, you know, if you want to explain the gag word for word.
No, I wasn't explaining the gag. I was just saying we have no Andrew this week. In case, just to clarify for the listeners, in case they were wondering.
His future hangs in the balance. You'll have to wait until Massive Crossover Event Part 2 to find out what happened next.
Yes. Anyway, in other news, J.J. Abrams is apparently doing a subversive superhero movie. He's producing it. It's going to be done for Paramount Pictures, and the only details we have are that it is going to be called The Heavy.
You see, I always imagined that if J.J. Abrams was going to direct a superhero live-action thing, it would be called Lens Flare, and that would be the superpower.
Oh.
and that our hero would blind his enemies by just projecting lens flare at them.
Are you familiar with the DC superhero, The Ray?
Could be renamed Lens Flare.
Yeah, he has light-based powers.
There you go. All we need to do is get someone with the same powers as Ray and get them to project them through a slightly mucky lens. We've got J.J. Abrams' superpower.
Yes. The thing that confuses me is it's called The Heavy.
Yeah.
And normally you would refer to The Heavy as, say, a henchman, you know, some kind of mob enforcer type person.
Unless, of course, that our hero, The Heavy, gets all his strength from grilled cheese sandwiches, because over time that would make him heavy.
This is a fundamental truth that I am very well aware of.
We know, but we didn't want to point it out.
Who's explaining the joke now?
I didn't explain the joke.
Anyway.
I just agreed with it.
True. Touché, good sir. Touché. Anyway. Yeah, he's going to be apparently teaming up with Julius Avery. So, once we know about him.
Is he any relation to animation legend Tex Avery?
I don't know. I certainly hope so. Once we know more details, we will let you know. So,
We can see them through all the lens flare.
Yes, keep your ears peeled. Moving on, though, in other news, DC have another television adaptation of Swamp Thing on the cards. This time it's going to be Aquaman director James Wan at the helm, or hopefully, anyway.
So, this is from someone linked to an Aquaman project?
Yes.
This will never happen, then.
No, it'll happen when the New Mutants movie comes out.
Oh, I've planned a retirement party for that day, for my grandson.
Basically, what they've got the synopsis as is, when CDC researcher Abby Arcane returns to her childhood home of Houma, Louisiana, in order to investigate a deadly swamp-borne virus, she develops a surprising bond with scientist Alec Holland, only to have him tragically taken from her. But as powerful forces descend on Houma, spelled H-O-U-M-A, not H-O-M-E-R, as in Simpson.
It sounds like a kind of Mediterranean cheese.
Yeah. But as powerful forces descend on halloumi.
Well, if you eat that much halloumi, especially if you're aiming to be a grilled cheese powered superhero, strange forces will emanate.
Yes. These strange forces are intent on exploiting the swamp's mysterious properties for their own purposes. I don't know what those mysterious properties are, but I have been in swamps and I can tell you the smell is definitely one of them. Abby will discover that the swamp holds mystical secrets, both horrifying and wondrous, and the potential love of her life may not be dead after all.
Dun, dun, dun! I'm sorry, that build-up just warranted that, I felt.
No, that's fine. I'm totally fine with that.
But yeah, is it only the third live? Is it only the third swap thing TV show?
Oh God, yes.
It feels like there's been more.
The thing is, it had a live action show on USA Network, and it had an animated series on Fox Kid. The one child.
Just that one viewer sat there. Maybe this is why there is no longer a Swamp Thing TV show.
Yeah, these were both...
Because the one Fox kid didn't like it.
These were both during the 90s.
It made him cry.
Now, my worry with this is that if Swamp Thing takes off, right, if it becomes successful, because The Flash and Arrow and Supergirl, to a degree, have done well for DC on TV. So there's no reason to think that Swamp Thing... you know, won't at least get some interest in it.
Yeah, and, well, I don't know. Because the thing about the success of Flash, Arrow, Supergirl, and even Legends of Tomorrow is that they're all part of a shared universe, you know.
Yeah.
They're all linked by Greg Berlanti. Now, Foxy's Gotham has a completely different tone. But of course, because it's the build up to Batman and a lot more of the characters are more familiar to people.
Yeah.
I love those shows though I do. The CW's output is very much second string DC hero.
Yeah. The thing that worries me about this is that if it is successful, it will encourage Marvel to do a live action Man Thing, which is not a good title.
No, and it also means that we'd be duty-bound to talk about our Man Thing every week.
Yeah.
And we've had that mistake once. Do you remember when I had a really thin Man Thing?
Well, I actually have the final issue of one of Marvel's runs of Man Thing, and it is, it literally is, on the cover, it says, giant-sized Man Thing, and it says, the tear-stained conclusion.
Anyway, moving on.
This is the actual comic book cover.
Because I am not touching that.
I didn't want to touch it. I showed it to Andrew when we were in the office. He's like, oh, I don't know what to do with this.
Yes.
Yeah, moving on.
Just before we move on, I do wonder whether there's room for another DC series, because we've already got Krypton, the prequel that nobody asked for.
Yeah.
Which actually isn't bad. You know, I'm about 6 or 7 episodes in, and it's not bad. It's all right.
Why don't we have Superman under witness protection?
Why would we do that?
Because it's a segue for the next story.
Yeah, I was hoping for a slightly more polished segue than that. But anyway.
Yes.
Who will rid me of this turbulent co-presenter?
You're stuck with me for the next hour.
Hour?
Anyway. It's come to light recently that because of a freedom of information thing, right, over in America, the FBI...
We have it here too.
Sorry?
We have it here too, you know.
Yeah, I know. We have it here as well. But I'm saying this was actually just in America. The FBI had to give out certain information about an investigation they did relating to the Church of Scientology. And because the Church of Scientology... at one point did a one-act play involving characters from DC's Superman comics, like Lois Lane and the Daily and Superman, you know, Clark Kent, Jimmy Olsen, things like that. Their names had to be redacted.
Hold on, Rob.
Yeah.
You're doing a news story that involves the Church of Scientology.
Yeah.
And the FBI.
And Superman.
Yeah, no, forget about Superman. the FBI and the Church of Scientology. I think we ought to do this in a whisper because one of those two organizations will be listening.
Okay. So anyway. So anyway, right?
Yeah.
In order to protect the privacy of people involved whose names were mentioned, the FBI had to redact loads of names from these documents, right?
Yeah.
Including the names of Lois Lane, Clark Kent, not Jimmy Olsen.
Well, we all know he's real.
And so we have this bizarre thing where fictional characters have had their names redacted for some reason. We're still not sure why.
Well, I suspect that maybe the guy who was handed the marker to do this redacting was just such a devoted DC fan that he actually believed they were real and that they deserved their privacy. And I think what we ought to do is hunt this man down because he clearly thinks that Jimmy Olsen doesn't deserve his privacy. And just the fact that he's a sort of add-on character that doesn't really add much to the storyline doesn't mean he hasn't got rights. The fact that he's fictional means he doesn't have rights.
This is true. And it is kind of a, you told me what story? The FBI redacted the names of Clark Kent and Lois Lane because of a one-act play that the Church of Scientology did involving them, even though they're fictional characters.
Hmm.
But they do say truth is stranger than fiction.
They do.
They do. Do you know what else is weird, though?
Everything.
Yes. But Canada has its own superhero, kind of their equivalent of Captain America, called Captain Canuck. Yeah?
Yes. You mean they have another superhero other than Logan?
Yes, they do. And Captain Canuck has no relation to Marvel or anything like that. But anyway, the Canadian government is cashing in on Captain Canuck, so to speak, and they have put together plans for a Captain Canuck commemorative coin.
Excellent.
Right? It's going to be produced by the Canadian National Mint, and it's going to be $20 It's going to be a $20 fine silver rectangular coin with Chapter House Publishing's flagship superhero.
But this is going to work like our commemorative coins, yeah?
Yeah, it's going to be exactly the same as our commemorative coins, only in silver, not gold.
All right, so it's going to be one of those things where there's going to be TV adverts all over Canada saying, get your Captain Canuck commemorative $20 coin. It'll cost you $20 plus your postage and packing.
Nope.
All right.
There's only going to be 3,500 of these coins made, right? And they're going to be 99.99% pure silver, which is basically pure silver, isn't it?
Well, you have to allow for a certain level of impurity, yes.
But the coins themselves, no, they're not going to be $20.
Oh, is it going to be one of those, like, sort of, you know, you actually buy it for slightly less than the value so that they automatically retain the value?
Nope. Think in the opposite direction.
All right, 25?
Nope, way higher.
50?
Higher.
60?
$120, or rather $119.95 Canadian.
So, in order to commemorate their national superhero, the Canadian Mint are extorting their population.
3,500 people from the population, yes.
Right.
And this is at the instigation of the Canadian government.
Okay.
Yeah.
They haven't been asked to fund a wall, have they?
Well, I'm pretty sure there are a lot of Canadians who would like a wall between them and America.
And I'm sure there are less covert ways that they need to be asked to fund it.
See, if it was me and I was the Canadian government, I'd just have like a wall of bears. I'd do the Sparta thing.
Now, you see, the thing is, this is Captain Canuck, and I don't know how well known Captain Canuck is outside of Canada.
Well, not very well known. You see the odd Captain Canuck comic book on Free Comic Book Day, but that's it.
So they've missed a trick here, because if they'd chosen Wolverine,
yes,
or Logan, they could have opened up the market, still had the limitation, flogged them on eBay. They wouldn't have had to set a minimum price.
Never mind Logan. I mean, everyone forgets the other Canadian superheroes called Alpha Flight.
No, they don't. It's just that the Canadian government have identified what would sell.
True. Hang on. No, they haven't. They got Captain Cannonkites.
Oh, dear. Have we got any more news?
No, thankfully. Thank God for that. Yes.
Other than, of course, that at the time of recording, we are 2 days away from the annual event that is Free Comic Book Day. So by the time you listen to this, dear listeners, you will have missed out. We probably should have tacked a mention onto the end of last week's show.
Yeah. Actually, there was one other small bit of news, which was just to mention more than anything else, and that was that Avengers Infinity War has become has the highest grossing box office of any movie on its opening weekend of all time.
Hold on. Are you saying that there's a new Marvel movie out?
Yes.
Oh, that must have passed me by.
Yeah, I know. I was surprised as well because, I saw this headline and was like, Avengers Infinity War? Don't recognize it.
No.
And then I found out it had the highest box office of all time. I was like, really? Yeah. This is a movie I've never heard of.
Well, they've not really made much of a song and dance about this, have they?
Nah.
I mean, that's the kind of thing where you change your logo at the beginning of the film to, say, 10 or something to mark the 10th anniversary of your combined universe.
Yeah, something like that, and where you do, like, loads of press tours with all sorts of actors and, everyone appears on Jimmy Kimmel repeatedly.
Yeah, loads of trailers where you just see, like, every superhero that's ever been in any of your films ever walking towards each other really slowly.
Oh, running really slowly. Don't forget the running really slow.
And flying and whatever other mode of transport that particular character does.
Yes. But
really slowly.
Yes.
It's a good job Lockjaw wasn't in it, really. That'd be quite dull watching a dog teleport really slowly.
true. So, yeah, obviously, it's obvious we've watched the film.
Well, obviously, especially any listeners of Cinema Eclectica who will have understood what all that crossover nonsense was at the beginning.
Exactly. So, anyway, I do think we need to talk about the biggest thing.
The ending.
Not the ending. Let's not talk about the ending. Because
the middle bit.
Well, we can talk about all of it within reason, but I think the thing that we need to acknowledge is that they actually, they actually did it. They took all of those characters and made a movie.
They did, and the big concern, and I think we mentioned it on here in the run up to it, and I know that when we met up with the guys from Cinema Eclectica or outside of the world of the podcast, when they let us out of our padded cells, we did discuss it. It's a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the big complaints we've had about sort of some films in franchises like Spider-Man 3, Batman Returns, those kind of films, there's too much character to spread around the film.
Yeah.
And yet they somehow managed to do it with Infinity War. You don't feel that you're robbed of any particular interaction. Yes, obviously, there's going to be fans of one superhero that's going to want more of that one. But
I don't know.
I think they did a good job of balancing the appearance, the screen time devoted to each character and group of characters.
Yeah, I mean, it was. You did get the sense that it was kind of proportional, the screen time that each character got.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is as well the clever way that they did it. To achieve that was they made it a Thanos film.
Yeah. And I think we do have to talk about Thanos because
that's the way Thanos would have it.
Well, I'm surprised at the approach. See, normally historically with Marvel movies, it's always been the bad guy has been this thing for the good guy to beat.
Yeah.
That's always been the case. But I mean, with Thanos, I had the speculation, right? That something had happened in Thanos' past which turned him into what he is now, right? It would explain a lot of things. And there is a section of the movie where it alludes to his past, where he actually talks a little bit about his past, right? But that then, that's after a certain event happens, which I'm not going to go into because it is a spoiler. But those two together made me think, hang on, what happened to him in the past?
Yeah.
that turned him into this, because it had to be something big and traumatic, you know, but very, very personal for him to take this route. There is no other reason why any normal sane person would suddenly flip like that. And the reason why I thought like that was Zemo in Black Panther.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't think I need to explain it any more than that, because then I'd be spoiling things.
Yes, and we don't want to spoil it.
But there was the thing, though, where after that event happens on the planet with the surprising cameo.
Mm-hmm.
After that happens, though, you got the sense that Thanos had suddenly, it's like he aged overnight. You know,
yeah.
He suddenly, the character seemed a lot more tired, and that's a credit to Josh Brolin, I think.
He
did a fantastic job.
To appear under that amount of makeup and CGI.
Yeah.
Still turning a performance like he does is a credit. And it means you don't have to be Andy Serkis to do it.
Yes. Oh my God. The next Planet of the Apes. Andy Serkis versus Josh Brolin.
Oh, yeah. The motion capture of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
But yeah, it is a great film. There were two standout moments for me, which hopefully won't be spoilers for anyone. And they both came from my fellow audience members at the screen now I went to see. The first one was, as events start to unfold at the end, one person yelled out, "But their contract's not ending." And then a couple of minutes later, "Oh my God, and neither is theirs."
Yeah, I think I know the ones that you're on about.
And we should tell, if you're one of the five people who haven't been to see the film yet, then we should warn you that you're in for a long wait for your post-credit sequence. It's absolutely right at the end. It's even after the logo for the Motion Picture Association of America goes past.
Yeah. But the post-credit sequence is worth the wait.
It is worth the wait, yes. But there's a logo that appears in that post-credit sequence. And when that logo appeared, another cinema goer near me went, "How are they going to squeeze Wonder Woman in?" I suspect that not everybody who went to see the screening I went to see is a comic book fan.
I suspect that you're right. Oh.
And on that bombshell...
Yeah, I think it's time for a break. But very quickly, before we go for the break, Avengers Infinity War is great. Very quick thing that I actually do want to mention before we go for a break, though. Very, very quick, right? There were certain bits that that I've noticed people found unsatisfactory, right? And the thing that I just want to remind people is this was originally planned as a two-part ending. But it's kind of gone in a different direction. The Russo brothers have realized a two-parter isn't the way forward for it. So they've basically done this, and then the final movie will actually tie up all the loose ends. So yeah, it might feel unsatisfactory, but it is just in the middle of the story.
Hold on, isn't what you've just described a classic two-parter?
It is, but you know, the original titles were supposed to be like Infinity War Part 1, Infinity War Part 2.
And I think also I'm duty bound to give out the same health warning that I give out on Eclectica regarding Avengers Infinity War. If you're the kind of person who has a weak bladder and struggles to get through 2.5 hours of movie without needing a visit, don't get a large drink before going into the cinema.
I was about to say, do not buy that giant sized Diet Pepsi.
Because there isn't one of those dull, quiet moments where you just can nip out without missing anything.
No, because if you nip out, you will miss a good chunk. Something will happen that you'll be going, no!
And depending on where in the film, someone you like might die.
Yeah, the thing is, that actually happened at the showing I went to. There's a guy who was literally two seats away from me, and he nipped out, went to the toilet. I think it was about two-thirds of the way into the movie, right?
Yeah.
Nipped out, went to the toilet. And then a major event happened. And he came back and he's like, "What the hell?"
So, this is advice more aimed at the male listener than the female listener. But if you do get that giant sized Diet Pepsi on the way in, other colas are available. Maybe hang on to the cup for a bit later on. You know what I mean?
Or another solution for you, incontinent pants.
Yes. Adult nappies.
Yes.
These are all sound pieces of advice. Maybe a sheen.
Yeah, these are essentials for watching Infinity War.
I should stress this is not because it's one of those long movies that just feels like you're in there for 3 days.
No, it
doesn't feel like it.
No, I will be honest. I sat there and it felt like I'd only been in about half an hour.
Yeah.
It did not feel like a 3 hour, like a 2.5-3 hour movie at all.
No.
And yeah.
So, shall we take a break there?
Yes, let's take a break there.
Or would that be too much of a cliffhanger?
Hey, so, films. Those are certainly things, right? And if you want to listen to much better film analysis than that, listen to Cinema Eclectica, also on the Geek Show Podcast Network.
Hello. I'm Professor Elemental, and whenever I'm not riding a badger around my grounds or hitting my monkey butler with a stick, I'm listening to The Geek Show, and my God, I love it.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there, and to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop, and buy some of our lovely wares. Buy them all.
Welcome back. And now it's time for the serious business of comic books, starting with Mick.
Yes. So I've been, as I mentioned earlier, I've been stuck in jungles this week.
Sorry? I was going to say, do you have jungle fever?
Sadly, no. My jungle experiences were less than exciting, I'm afraid to say.
Oh, that's a shame.
So we'll start off in Wakanda. Ooh, topical. We'll start off in Wakanda and Black Panther Shuri, the deadliest of the species.
Okay.
So it actually starts off as quite a nice story. Well, I say nice. It's not that nice. But it starts off as a story where the Black Panther has gone off on a secret mission. He's told absolutely no one. He's turned off all his GPS, everything. He's not being tracked. He's gone off for a secret meeting. And when he's come back, he's barely hanging on to life, okay? T'Challa comes back completely incapacitated, on the verge of death, and the doctors are doing everything they can for him, and that's not much, even with Wakandan technology. Which, of course, leads to a little bit of a crisis, because if T'Challa's out of action, it means Wakanda's spiritual protector, the Black Panther, is also out of action.
True. Very true.
So that means that someone has to do the Trial of the Panther to take up that mantle while T'Challa is struggling.
I wonder who that could possibly be.
Well, I think the title Black Panther Shuri maybe gave it away.
Yeah, it kind of did.
So, yeah, T'Challa's younger sister goes off, does a set of trials, takes the weed and faces the Panther God. And there's a twist, which is really new.
Just takes the weed and faces the Panther God.
You know, the magic weed. The magic weed from the magic weed plant.
I know. It's just...
Everybody knows about the magic weed in Black Panther, right?
It just conjures up a whole different set of images when she meets the Panther God and they just sit
She and the Panther God just sit there having the munchies.
Yes.
So anyway, she does the whole thing of sort of asking the Panther God to bestow her with the power of the Panther so that she can protect Wakanda. And it doesn't actually go according to plan.
Okay, that's a bit of an odd situation to be in.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to go too much further into the plot because it's a twist and it's quite an interesting twist. And the twist actually plays a big part in what happens next to Shuri.
Okay.
There are guest appearances in the early part by Prince Nemo and Doctor Doom by way of flashback.
Yeah.
And it also features Queen Aurora.
Oh, is this from the time when Storm and T'Challa were married then?
It is indeed.
Ah.
So, and the villain of the piece that's trying to attack Wakanda in its moment of weakness is Morlun, who is a bad guy that I was unaware of.
I've never heard of him.
But he's some kind of undead creature. He can sap life force. And as he does so, he also absorbs the skills and talents of those people. He's like a bad version of the slime in that time I got reincarnated as a slime.
Yeah, I had a flick through this, and the thing that I noticed about it was that his character, when I had a flick through Black Panther Shuri, I saw his character. I was like, so he's basically a white dude. So isn't he basically Tom Cruise in The Last Samurai and that guy from Brother the Wolf and what's his face, Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves? Isn't he like the super white guy who can do the tribal things better than the tribal people?
Well, the mention that he's a former foe who seems to have some kind of command over the afterlife and can be summoned by this tribe that lives somewhere in a hut. I mean, it's not a very powerful tribe because there only seems to be about five of them. But it's an empty villain, and the overwhelming feeling you get from reading Black Panther Shuri's an engaging protagonist.
Yeah,
obviously there's a lot of banter between Aurora and the Queen Mother and the other leaders of Wakanda. There's also some nice, almost like stepsisterly moments between Aurora and Shuri, because obviously Aurora's not going to sort of knock Shuri back in her attempts to become, in her attempts to fulfill her destiny. So there's some nice moments in it, but the overall feeling you get is of a nice story kind of spoiled, because imagine you go to watch a Spider-Man movie. I'll keep it in the Marvel Universe. You go to watch a Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
All right. And they insist on doing what they always do and retell the origin story.
Yeah. Okay.
So Peter Parker goes off, gets bitten by a radioactive spider, gets his new powers, fails to stop Uncle Ben from being killed, realizes that power with great power comes with great responsibility. And that's the end of your movie.
Okay. That sounds like a kind of boring movie, I'll be honest.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's the, you kind of want, everything that happens in this, I mean, this is collecting a 2009 series of six issues. You kind of want all of what happens in here to happen in part one. And then issues 2 to 6, you want to see Shuri doing her thing.
Yeah.
Which sounded better in my head. the artwork's decent. My only complaint is that There are some scenes where Shuri looks more like a sort of cut price Catwoman.
Yeah, the cover doesn't really sell it that well, because I looked at the cover and thought, my God, how many muscles are there on this character?
Yeah, and they don't actually appear to attach to any kind of bone structure.
Yeah,
I mean that's just the cover art. The interior art is much better. And there's some nice variant covers towards the back. Like I say, it'd be nice. I don't know whether that 2009 series ran any further. It would be nice to continue on from this, but as a standalone collection, it's not great. It's a bit disappointing. It's fun while it lasts. It just doesn't last long enough.
That's a shame.
So it's written by Reginald Hudlin, which is an unlikely name for a comic book writer. You'd at least expect him to shorten it to Reg, wouldn't you?
I don't know. Reg Hudlin doesn't really roll off the tongue either.
No.
Reggie Hudlin?
Yeah. Anyway, so art by Ken Lashley, Paul Neary and Paul Mounts. Cover art is by J. Scott Campbell and Edgar Delgado. And it, meh. is about as good as I can say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's all right.
Sorry, Reg.
It's all right. It's interesting you mentioned Spider-Man earlier, because I actually have Spider-Man 2, which is kind of a... It's a five-part series which combines elements of The Amazing Spider-Man and Spider-Man, as in the Miles Morales Spider-Man. And this is written by Brian Michael Bendis with art by Sarah Pacelli. And it is... basically, it's after Mysterio causes caused a breach in dimensions, and so things happen, and Miles Morales somehow ends up on Peter Parker's side of the universe, and he's, you know, they're making ends meet, everything is happening, but, you know, Miles is having difficulty coping with the fact that he is now a Spider-Man as well, right?
Uh-huh.
And so it's only natural because he's a teenager in school. And so Peter is trying to do his best to kind of help Miles through it, having been through it himself. But he's only a few years older than Miles. So, you know, he gets uncomfortable when Miles calls him Mr. Parker, you know.
Okay.
Well, you would get uncomfortable. I mean, think about it. If somebody who was only 3 years younger than you, you know, started calling you Mr. Whatever, you know, you'd say, well, why you call me that?
Yeah. I guess.
Yeah, but anyway, Miles is doing his thing and Peter is doing his thing, you know, fighting guys called Armadillo, dealing with various things. And it was interesting to see this particular comic have a focus on Miles and how his, you know, and how he's trying to cope with being in Spider-Man's shadow, but being Spider-Man himself and trying to balance school and being a superhero and things like that. It's a very different animal to what you saw with Peter Parker. And one of the things that they run into, both Spider-Men, right at the beginning, is Taskmaster, the guy who can basically copy any superhero's moves. He's a mercenary, mercenary just like Deadpool is. And this time, Taskmaster is actually working for somebody else who surprisingly bears a strange resemblance to Miles Morales. Only older and with a scarred face. So that immediately got my attention, and the story then goes into the history of this guy with a scarred face, and it kind of loops around on itself in, you know, going through flashbacks until you actually realize what's going on. And when you realize what's going on, it's kind of tragic.
This sounds like season 3 of The Flash.
It kind of is. This is basically... you have another guy called Miles Morales who is basically, he's learned that he was involved in a crime family at one point, but he wanted out and he was good friends with Wilson Fisk. And he was basically a business partner to Fisk, and they were like best man at each other's weddings and stuff like that. And he got out, but his wife died. And Fisk's wife, Vanessa, had died already. And so Fisk has basically said, look, this is what got me through it, and told him about there's a way to go to other dimensions, to a dimension where your wife is still alive. And that's what this Miles Morales has basically been working towards, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay.
Overall, like I said, the story is kind of tragic when it goes into the history of the adult version of Miles Morales, because unlike the teenage version, who has superpowers and who was basically trying to balance balance being a student, being a teenager, being a superhero. The adult Miles Morales didn't have any of those, you know? Yeah. And so what you get is effectively a what might have been if Miles Morales had never been bitten by the spider.
Right.
Which is interesting to read.
Hmm.
You know, it's interesting to read. Okay, it's not the best work from Brian Michael Bendis, but he does understand Spider-Man a lot better than most of the writers do. Let's be fair.
Okay.
Mainly because he's written more of Spider-Man than just about anybody else.
He has written a lot of Spider-Man.
Exactly.
Maybe too much Spider-Man.
Maybe that's why he left Marvel and went to DC. They took Spider-Man away from him. He's going, no, it's my Spider-Man, mine.
Step away from the webs, Brian.
Oh, can you imagine if he'd written so much Spider-Man, he was actually thinking he was Spider-Man?
No, I think it's a lot simpler than that. Because if a man is okay at writing Spider-Man, why would they take it away from him? I think what they did was they found out that he'd written the foreword to the Inkle, that he'd been inspired by it.
Oh, Because he did, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh. On that note, it's your turn.
It is, isn't it? So, what could possibly be better than a Punisher collection?
A Punisher collection where the Punisher isn't the Punisher.
Hold that thought. A Punisher collection.
Did I just guess that right?
Written by Garth Ennis.
Oh, God.
Yeah, right? I was looking forward to this so much. So, this is Punisher, the Platoon, by Garth Ennis, art by Goran Parlov. And it collects Punisher, the Platoon, 1-8. And it's set in Vietnam. Told me, basically an author who's written a book about Frank Castle's life as the Punisher, has managed to track down the guys that were in his platoon in Vietnam and wants to ask them some questions to try and ascertain what it was that turned Frank Castle into the killing machine that he is, beyond the established facts of the death of his wife and daughter.
Okay, see, that to me immediately sounds like an interesting idea, you know?
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the framing mechanism's quite interesting. The problem is when you get into it, it's basically just the lieutenant that's portrayed. Sorry, I'm English. The lieutenant that's portrayed in here doesn't have to be Frank Castle. It could be any one of those guys you see in Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, though, you know, those kind of movies.
Yeah.
What this isn't is a Punisher novel. It's a novel about the ridiculousness of the Vietnam War. It's a novel about the horrors and the horrific decisions that men in that theatre had to face, but it's not a Punisher novel. The fact that the lieutenant's called Frank Castle is almost incidental.
Because
you get a lot of people who go and learn how to be soldiers.
Yeah.
But they don't all become a man like the Punisher. So I think that the thing that did turn the man into the Punisher is the very thing that we all know and love turned Frank Castle into the Punisher.
Which is interesting because it also ties in with what I said about Thanos.
Yeah, this is not how Frank Castle became the Punisher. This is just where he learned the skills that he could then employ as the Punisher. Because the thing is, you know, if you or I, who haven't been trained in the use of weaponry, were put in Frank Castle's later situation, we couldn't become the Punisher. Not without picking it up from scratch. We'd have to learn those skills.
Yeah, we couldn't make phone calls like Liam Neeson does.
Oh.
You know? I mean, your special skills would be project management. Mine would be...
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to find someone like the Punisher, tell them the timescale I would like them to work to, how much I've got to pay them, and what objectives they need to finish off. But this is my point. This does not... the whole premise of this is about finding out the first kill, what turns Frank Castle into the Punisher. It isn't. This is about what makes Frank Castle survive Vietnam. And it's the same as a million other Vietnam vet stories.
See, that's a shame, because they had the opportunity of actually doing something interesting there.
Yeah. And it is interesting, but it's interesting without needing the... It's almost like the Punisher logo's on here to sell it.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't see how what you've just described is any different from First Blood Part 1.
No, and it's not. And that's my point. This could be Johnny Rambo. It could be someone from Platoon. It could be someone from Full Metal Jacket. It could be someone from any of those sort of war movies with a conscience.
It could be Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump.
Yeah. It's, you know, the most interesting character in it, actually, is... And there's not enough background about her, but there's this female Vietnamese soldier who is as cold-blooded as Frank Castle in the battle. And her one aim is to kill Americans. But you don't get enough of her history. You don't get enough of her story. And she's actually a quite fascinating character. Because she pretty much, at one point, takes on Frank's entire platoon single-handed.
Wow.
So that's Punisher the Platoon by Garth Ennis. It's good, but it's not the Punisher.
That's a shame.
And that's its Fatal Flaw. If I'd have picked that, if that had just been called The Platoon, I would probably have enjoyed it more.
That's a fair point.
So, what are you taking us out on?
I am taking us out on a movie, which is, I know, it's an odd thing.
Hold on, we've got a dedicated podcast for those.
Yeah, but this is actually an adaptation from a manga.
Oh, well, in that case, carry on. I've got my objection.
Yes. This is actually the movie version of a manga series by Hiroaki Samura, who fans of the manga series will recognize the name immediately and know what I'm talking about, Blade of the Immortal. And this is a film directed by Takashi Miike. And I don't know, are you familiar with Takashi Miike's work?
I may be. I just may not know it.
Let's see. He did Ichi the Killer and... he's done various other things as well.
Was that a live-action one?
Ichi the Killer live-action was Takashi Miike, MPD Psycho, My Neighbor's... I think Yakuza Apocalypse. He's done various other things, like Sukiyaki Western Django. The Happiness of the Katakuris was his. You know, that weird comedy horror musical... which is like The Sound of Music, but with lots of death.
Okay.
Yeah.
You anyway. Well, clearly, he's done a lot of stuff then.
Yeah, he's one of the most prolific directors in Japan. And so there's an interesting documentary on this disc with Takashi Miike where he talks about the actual production. And because this series, they have made the attempt at adapting the manga as a live action movie before. It's had an anime adaptation. I think the anime adaptation was in 2008, and it was only like 13 episodes, and it was decent enough. But with the rise of various other live action adaptations of manga and anime, especially certain titles like Rurouni Kenshin, which had done really well, obviously they thought, okay, there is scope to do a period piece here. And so Blade of the Immortal is a period piece. It deals with samurai, it deals with lots of blood and death and stuff like that. And the story is basically about Manji, who is, he's known as the 100-man killer. And he's a samurai on the run because he killed a corrupt lord and his bodyguards. And basically, various things have happened. And so Manji is basically in a situation now where he has been cursed with these things called bloodworms, and these bloodworms will heal his body repeatedly no matter how many times he is injured. He's basically like Wolverine now, right?
Okay.
Now imagine a one-eyed scarred samurai who's basically like Wolverine and has like ridiculous skills, but only because he's been fighting for so long now. Everybody right. wants to kill him, right? And so he becomes the bodyguard of a young girl called Rin, who is out for revenge against the people who basically destroyed her dojo, killed everyone that she cared about. And so she hires Manji to basically become her bodyguard and help her get revenge. And so it becomes this thing where the two of them actually start developing this weird bond, kind of a brother-sister, father-daughter bond, because Manji actually had a sister who died and her death was something that he ultimately caused. And so he's never actually forgiven himself for that, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's looking at this, and you get the sense from the actors that he's actually looking at Rin and seeing her as a type of redemption for himself. If he can help her and save her, then maybe he can forgive himself for the death of his sister.
Okay.
So I'm actually very surprised, right? I've watched a lot of live-action adaptations of various manga and anime and stuff like that, and most of them, I'll be honest, are rubbish, you know. Very, very few good ones. Rurouni Kenshin adaptation was good, mainly because it's a period piece, and Japan does period pieces, especially samurai period pieces. They do them very, very well because they have a lot of history with them, you know. If you look at the old Japanese movies that deal with samurai, they've got a lot of background with them. They can basically build on the foundations they've already laid for decades. You know, it's like if you went to Hollywood and you said, okay, we want to make a Western. They've got decades of Westerns to go through, haven't they?
Yeah.
You know, you can't teach Hollywood how to make a Western in the same way you can't teach Japanese directors how to make a samurai movie. They already know.
Yeah.
And this is basically a samurai movie through and through. And Takashi Miike, he's got some interesting actors on this. The lead role of, the lead role of Manji is played by Takuya Kimura, who is interesting because he's been a singer and an actor for about 25 years. And in Japan, Miike actually explains this in the documentary that goes with this. He actually explains that Takuya Kimura, basically, he stepped forward and said, yeah, I want to do this. You know, let's do it. Let's just crack ahead and do this. Because he's got kind of, he's got one of those images that a lot of people in Japan would say, you need to protect this image. You've got a wholesome image. You're a dad. You're a family man. You need to protect this image. You can't be spoiling this image by doing something like playing the role of Manji, who is basically a foul-mouthed killer, you know?
Yeah.
And so he stepped on shaky ground for himself, but I reckon he's done an amazing job. He really pulls it off with this role. And Hana Sugisaki, who plays the role of Rin, she does really well as the character of Rin. Now, I've read the manga. I'm familiar with the manga, and I am a big fan of the manga. It's got a lot of things to recommend and not many things that you'd say, okay, I don't like that, from my perspective anyway. It's got that kind of fantastic element because Manji is the only person who has these bloodworms and he doesn't know how to get rid of them. All he really wants to do is find a way to die. You know?
All right.
So, and this is the thing that actually resonates in the film as well. And it's surprising because this is one of those films where if somebody wanted to get into manga, you know, but was a bit hesitant about reading something like Blade of the Immortal, which, let's be fair, it's a long series, you know. It's a long series. It's 30 volumes.
Right.
Okay, so that's not easy to get through, is it?
No.
But if they wanted to have something that was condensed and actually gave them a good overview of what the film, of what the manga is like, this is it right here.
Okay.
You know, and this would give them a good taste of kind of the visceral nature of the manga, the level of violence in the film is actually very reflective of the level of violence in the manga. The characters are not as cartoonish as I've seen in other films, and I reckon that's because Takashi Miike has looked at this and said, okay, you know, the manga is very, it has this nature, it has this cult following. So we need to try and adapt that. We need to tone down the cartoonish nature of some of the bad guys and say, okay, this is how we want them. And there's one amazing guy who his arm has been cut off at the forearm, right? And this has happened to Manji, and Manji had part of the bone sticking out. And so he started, because he's basically immortal, he started killing people with the bone that was sticking out of his arm.
Are you basically telling me that he lost part of his arm and started beating people to death with a soggy end?
Yeah, basically with the bony soggy, with the bony protrusion in the soggy end. And so this guy, after Manji cuts off part of his arm, this guy has the same idea. And basically he's bound his arm, but has the bone sticking out, and he's sharpened the bone into points so he can use it as a weapon. And all of this is just so he can get revenge on Manji.
Okay.
And so that's what I mean by the visceral nature of it. It's very brutal. But ultimately, it's actually quite satisfying in terms of its action. There's a lot of, this is the kind of film that I think if you're into, violent films, especially violent samurai films, you know, things like Zatoichi or, Lone Wolf and Cub, stuff like that, then I think this will satisfy you in a lot of ways. It's a very good adaptation of the manga. I'm surprised at how closely it actually follows the manga. The costuming is great. The acting is very, very good. Takashi Miike has done an excellent job directing. I recommend this to any fan of the manga or to anybody who is interested in getting into the manga but finds it, the length of it a bit daunting.
Okay.
And that's actually out now. So,
cool.
Blade of the Immortal. Good, solid recommend from me.
Excellent.
Yes. So that's us for this week.
Is it?
Yeah,
is that
that's
what
it.
Time for?
Yeah, that's basically it. Unless you have something else you want to add.
No, I'll leave it for when the New Mutants come out.
Okay, so if you want to catch up with any of our other shows, you'll find them on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or our website, which also has our shop, which you can find by clicking on The Geek Shop on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, where we have some lovely, lovely merchandise which you can buy with your monies, or you can donate to our Patreon. Choice is yours. Yeah, that's it. Until next time, I've been Rob.
I've been Mick.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.